Kia ora Aotearoa and welcome to Generally Famous, the Stuff Podcast. I'm Simon Bridges and every week I talk to a generally famous but always interesting guest about life, love and what makes them tick. Today's guest, journalist, TV host, NZ Media big timer, Patrick or Paddy Gower.
Quite an intro. Thank you, Simon.
But you know, you're like, how did it happen? You went from respected sort of journalist to you are like the brand. You are the product. You are the thing that you know, small children want selfies with.
Yeah, I don't know how it happened along the way. I mean, there's a few things that happened. I swore in a library, and I think that that really changed things.
And like at the Queen or something.
Yeah, that was
basically.
There was a lot later. The train was well and truly on the tracks by then. But yeah, for me, it is kind of quite mind blowing how it all happened. I mean, I sort of do know how it happened. You know, I was on TV. Some funny things happened, and I've done lots of different stuff, but there was never a plan for that to happen. That was, you know, when I was young, it was never anything that I ever thought about or sort of wanted to end up like this. I mean, I guess I was a class clown.
Me too.
Yeah. And now I'm sort of, you know, a bit of a class clown of the nation in some ways.
I mean, that's a bit hard. I don't know. I wouldn't go class clown if the... I remember actually intermediate, Mr. Den Hartog. And I remember hearing him and the principal of Te Atatū Intermediate talking about me, talking about who'd be student leader, right? I just remember this. And it haunts me to this day. And they said, yeah, he'd be all right. He's good. He's got leadership qualities, but a bit of a clown.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting, actually, Simon, because I could tell you identical stories about me. That was probably what all of my teachers said. And then, you know, they would say, oh, if he could stop being such a clown, he could do really well. And he does have some leadership qualities. I think I eventually got into such a clown that they probably stopped saying that he had leadership qualities for a little while. All of these people saying the stuff about me. I could bring in a stack of school reports that would say the exact same
thing. Me too.
Yeah, and there's
some themes there.
Yeah, I can definitely see it with you as well. I mean, and I can sort of see what I was like.
But look at us now. It's okay.
That's right. We made it.
Sometimes the worst traits are the best traits at a level. If you can rein them. I remember actually, we're going to stop this right now. It's not about me. It is about you. But I also remember, but I feel like this is good therapy. Actually, not that long after that, my mother taught at the same school.
Ooh.
And she was really upset because another teacher kept complaining about how arrogant I was.
Ooh. In the staff room?
Yes.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, that sort of had to get knocked out of me in a few ways. But and brand is maybe the wrong word, but you are this big personality. Everyone in New Zealand literally knows who you are. Do you think that changes you? Does it make you, I don't know, not go out, want to be home on a Friday night without people around, need to go for your holidays to kind of Australia where there'd still be hundreds of thousands of New Zealanders who probably know you but that don't know you?
For me, I actually do like being out and around people, so I don't mind so much, but there will be weekends and times where I'm just like, I just don't really want to see anyone. And I don't think that's necessarily because people notice me when I'm out and walking around and want to say good day. To be honest, Simon, I actually love it when people
but it is
come
work,
up and talk
though.
To me. It is. And then in the kind of job that I do, which is broadcasting and, you know, in a newsroom like the stuff one here, you know, News Hub, you know, they're pretty active places as well. And it might surprise people that, yeah, I do actually become quite introverted now, especially as I'm getting older.
Yeah.
Like I don't really want to go and see friends or do anything at the weekends. I just want to chill. And I think that's because during the week, it's obviously pretty full on. I love it. I wouldn't change it for a moment. I love it when people come up and talk to me in the street and want to have a yak with me. I do like it, you know, 90% of the time.
But like I noticed it when you came in here. We've just walked through the Stuff newsroom, you know, what's that, 100 metres? Well, maybe not 100, but a fair few metres. Lots of desks, open space. People come up to you, right? You were like a politician then. You had, and I don't mean that in a bad way, yeah. It takes one to know one, but like yeah. you had to stop and pretend you were interested in people, and maybe you were, but and the good politicians are, that's why I was never a good one, but you going up, giving them the time of day, it was like politics.
Yeah, I guess politics, but it's a little easier for me because, I don't have to promise anything to these people. So
that's true. Hey, I've written here you started as a journalist, and that's I meant to write it like that. I mean, are you still one now, or are you something else now?
I'm definitely something else now. I'm definitely a broadcaster, personality, and all of these other things, probably an entertainer as well at some points. But I am a journalist. I love it. It's all I've ever done. Every day for my whole working life, since my first job, I've got up and I've done journalism.
What do you like about it?
I love digging stuff up. I love bringing that out to people, and I just love the grit of it. I love the camaraderie. Yeah. I love everything about it. It's just been, such an amazing job for me. I can remember sort of my first stories for the New Zealand Herald and getting the paper out of the dairy with my name on the front page and stuff like that. And I've never looked back. I've never, ever thought about doing anything else, really. A couple of times later in life I thought about it. But
singing on a cruise ship?
yeah, or doing something. But I don't know, it's just me. And, despite all of these other titles that I've tacked on to myself, it's journalist that's at the core, and broadcaster and personality and entertainer and Paddy and all of these different things that other people think, and documentaries, they all sit around the core, really, which is being a journo.
It's funny, actually, I used to get, not media training, it just occurs to me while I'm listening to you talk there, but that I can't remember who, but certain minders would say to me, don't call him Paddy, it's familiar and friendly, and that's when he's about to screw you, know? So yeah. I've taught myself out of calling you Paddy. It's familiar and friendly when you are the enemy.
And
so you are Patrick Gower.
No, I remember that. And when I was
working, it's like you're about to shaft me, and I'm all friendly with you calling you Paddy. It's like, no, you're not Paddy Gower.
Well, I remember when I was in working in Parliament, in the press gallery, and trying to trip people like you up every single day, like coming to work and just like, how are we going to get these guys? How are we going to get Bridges? Yeah. It's like, how will we get Bridges or something like that, And you'd sort of zone in on one of them. And, I do remember, John Key would sometimes call me Paddy. And every time any politician ever called me Paddy, I would use it on TV.
Yeah, I know. Which is the same with Tova, right? I mean, it was just like, no, don't use their names.
Yeah.
They are not, they do not deserve that for that behavior. And, but like sort of a school teacher thing about their children. I wanted to ask you, originally you were in print. I'm obviously not a journalist, but my wife was, and I have this sort of thing where, like, it's just a silly, but that print is the superior sort of form of it, right? There's something about it that's, I mean, you went from, have you ruined yourself going the other way into media celebrity kind of television nonsense?
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because when I started, I wanted to be a feature writer, and not just a feature writer for a newspaper. I thought that I was going to become a feature writer for the New Yorker or something like this, and write these massively long 16-page articles about a politician or an All Black, where you would just reveal all the stuff about them by painting these huge pictures around them.
Yes.
So I thought when I started
reading significance and how they scratch their nose and
that's right, how they breathe and some small sort of observation that you tease out into some giant sort of in depth understanding of this person's personality. So I thought I was going to go more when I started in print. Yeah, I did think it was superior. I thought television, I just couldn't understand why people wanted to do it. And I did actually think that I was in the superior medium, and I wanted to go into the more superior side. But I got into television and I got hooked. I always thought maybe it started off as maybe something I'd do for a year, see what it was like, do for 2 years, see what it was like, get to an election. Maybe I'd do it for 10 years and go back to print. And it just never happened.
Do you write it all now?
Yeah,
is there any writing? I'm just trying to think.
Yeah, so I'll write the things that I say. I'll write an opinion piece. Right. So you do a lot of writing for television.
Yes.
There is actually
it's
some
also used
some
online
writing
on
and used for online and stuff. But I don't get as much time to. I would like to write a column and I'd like to write a column on politics.
You'll be getting a phone call after this.
Yeah, I just thought I'd say that inside stuff.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I actually don't have time in the week.
To
do a good job. And I've always said I'd love to get back to writing. And I say that, and I never do because all of this other stuff sort of has come cascading in. But you know, I'd really like to write a book, not just I'd like to write a book about my life. But I'd also like to write one about a big topic, like a story or something like that.
Yes.
You know, not a non-fiction one, but a non-fiction one. But
yes.
Whether I ever get the time to do anything.
Well, what
like
will
that.
Happen after this is one of them will call you and say, "Look, we'll give you $60,000 if you, and then you'll say yes because you'll take the $60,000 for that holiday to Hawaii or whatever it is that you want to do, or paying the mortgage or something, and then you'll have the stress of having to write it.
Yeah, and no, I don't want the stress.
Well, everyone's got one book in them. Actually think you'd find the book about you. Would it be? I don't know. It would be that hard. I think it would spew. For me, it spewed out of you.
Yeah.
The issues one, I think, would be quite hard work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like I'd like to write a book about if something big happened, sort of the scale of Pike River or something like that. You know, I'd like to get in and do
Rebecca
something.
McPhee. That's her. She done that one.
That was an amazing book, and something like that. I'd like to do. Whether I can ever get around to it and get the time, who knows? The way things are going.
I was going to go. I mean, you were a police reporter. You came back. You were in the UK. Came back. Politics, yeah, press gallery.
I'm skipping all the way forward to the book already.
And then TV. My this might be unfair, and it may be that I'm sort of putting you with half a dozen other political.
It'll be fair.
No,
it'll
I just feel like my vague recollection is you originally struggled with the format of TV.
Oh.
Or have I made
that's
that
not
up?
Vague at all.
Yeah.
I was appalling on screen. I had no training whatsoever, and as I said to you earlier, I had no interest in doing it, and I was a shocker. And people, when I tell them that these days, younger reporters coming into television, they sort of, I don't think people really realise how bad I was. And I think because of a few things, you know, I'd come out of print and I really didn't know what I was doing, and I got chucked right in the deep end, which is the TV3 way, and just sink or swim type thing. And then obviously because, you know, of my looks as well, which are, I think, unconventional for a television reporter as well, to have this.
I like that, unconventional, rugged looks. You could be like a character actor in Hollywood.
Yeah.
A bad guy in a Bond movie, possibly.
Yeah, I could do that.
That would be good.
I've always thought that would be my calling. And I think people just struggled when I first came on TV.
Mr. P.
To deal with what was in front of them, you know, this untrained, wooden, pretty weird looking, you know, a lot of people, and I've said this before, a lot of people would call me ugly when I first came on TV, or even now, really. And that meant that it was absolutely brutal introduction to TV. It was really, really hard. And Facebook and different things had not really started up, you know, Twitter and all of that. Social media was really
which
only,
was good.
It was good, yeah. Because I would not have survived. I don't think
because you wouldn't have been tough enough, or because do you think that they might have come and said, "Oh, this isn't working"?
Yeah, I think no, I wouldn't have been tough enough to deal with the kind of comments about the way that I looked, the way that I was on TV. And I always remember going to Christmas and with my cousins and. My cousin had a few beers and he was just like, "Oh my God, I can't watch you on TV."
Sounds like me and family things, politics, guys.
Yeah, they were like, I can't
watch you. Shut up. I don't want to know what you think.
Yeah.
Unless it's good.
Yeah, and I found that really hard, you know, to sort of hear that from a relative as well. He didn't mean it in a hard way.
No.
You know, he was just sort of.
He was just speaking loosely.
And I just realized that was. You know, I knew that a lot of people thought that as well. And, you know, like, what is he doing on TV? And, yeah, so it was really hard the first, the first year in particular was really, really hard. After about 18 months, it started to get a lot easier, and I started to get onto some big stories. You know, the election was on up here. There was the Kapiti and Epsom and Banksy and Keezy and doing the deal and all of that sort of stuff, and I really started to get into the journalism side of things, and that was after about 18 months. But those first 6 months, 12 months, like, they were among the hardest months of my life, because comments would seep through and you could just tell by the way that people were reacting and how people at TV3 were trying to help me to get better. And, you know, my confidence was rock bottom, really. You know, it was really, really struggling, I guess. And, you know, then it all started to turn around. Yeah.
And you're not remotely ugly, but I know what is true is you're not some AI created, normal kind of looking, you know, you're distinctive. And you're very tall, as I've been saying to you in the latrines of stuff.co.nz. But in a way, they end up being strengths, right? Don't they? Because it's like you're not generic weather person. You are Paddy Gower brand.
And I think it's you know, it's funny thinking about it, isn't it? Because, you know, people don't say stuff like that anymore about me struggling to do it, because obviously I've been doing it for nearly 15 years now and it's not a struggle. But, you know, at some point that sort of started to stop. But it was always good when people would say, you were bad when you began, but you're getting good now.
Yeah.
And that would just give me a massive boost, you know, if someone said that.
Because they're changing their perception.
Yeah, yeah,
on the basis of you doing what you did well.
Yeah.
Hey, you, and you were you were political editor at TV3. How long did you do that gig for? Quite a while.
I did that for 5 years.
Five years.
And, you know, if you want to talk about hard jobs, you know, it's nowhere near as hard as the leader of the opposition. I know how hard the leader of the opposition, that role is, because I made it hard for people. You know, I was part of what made it hard for people. I was, you know, it was a small factor in what would make, you know, I wasn't there while you were leader of the opposition, but, you know, I know what that job requires, because I'd watch it every day and I would be part of the problem for a leader of the opposition. I was part of the problem for Phil Goff. I was part of the problem for David Cunliffe. I was part of the problem for Andrew Little.
Shearer.
And Shearer, I was a big part of the problem for him.
The fish or whatever, weren't you? That was you?
Yeah, I was around with all the coups against him and undermining him and hacking him down and making him look bad on TV and saying that he wasn't up to it when I was commentating, like, constant. This is like, you know, over a period of 6 months, you've been in these places where guys like Shearer have been. You know what it's like. And, you know, I was a big part of that. And with Shearer in particular, David Shearer, and that shows you the sort of the way that when you start talking about politics, you never call someone by their first name. You know, it's always like Bridges, or Key, or Shearer, or Goff, because you don't actually view them necessarily as a person when you're the journalist. Well, I didn't anyway. You sort of just view them as this amorphous thing. You know, you view them as Key, you view them as Shearer, you view them as Bridges, and it becomes like that. And you know, with David Shearer in particular, you know, I really wanted to make my mark. You know, I wanted to be like Duncan, who, you know, he had really taken on Phil Goff. He would expose every frailty of Labor's. You know, he had scalps, as we call them, you know, hanging, you know, of ministers that he'd taken out and stuff. And I kind of thought that I really needed to take out an opposition leader, you know, and Shearer was the one that was there, and I just kind of thought that was my role. So obviously, it's part of it. If an opposition leader is weak and is facing huge instability from within their own caucus, that's
a true story.
That is an absolute true story. So it's one to follow, and that's your job, and that should never change.
What I suppose I find interesting about it, though, is it's not, and I don't mean this in a judgmental way, because it is what it is at a level, but it's not fair. Like, it's somehow the sort of the circadian rhythms of it. They get a better go than a new opposition, because they're new, and we just have this sort of view that there's this cycle, And so the hard go and the pressure's got to be on one side. And, of course, that changes by the end of a government, right?
Yeah.
In the last 3 to 4 or 5 years, possibly, where the pressure comes off an oppositional level, and that cycle and how people are treated, or a government opposite, it changes over time. Would you agree with that, or is that not?
I do. I think circadian rhythm is a really good term for it. It's always like when I first came into politics, Helen Clark's government was on the way out, and I was watching it in its last year, and Key's lot were on the way in, including you. And that first term for Phil Goff, there's all these cliches like the phone is off the hook, and you know, you've got to take the bullet, and someone's got to do it, and stuff like that, which is sort of that role that you were in as well. You know, you were as an opposition leader against an ascendant opposition and an ascendant leader, and there is some sort of rhythm there that person has to lose, I guess, or not make it, or fail, or all of the above. And I think that's partly to do with the media, it's partly to do with politics itself, but it's also the public sort of feeding in. The public does have some sort of role
it's a Kiwi
well.
Fairness thing. Yeah. I think what the best elections and the best political operators, it's a bit like a jury trial, dare I say, are the ones where the side wins that, quote, shouldn't, because they've outplayed the other guys.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, not that it should be a sport, but you know what I mean? I think really what we're saying here is at a level there is some of that, right? Because, you know, that's media, that's politics. And they're the ones you look and say, that leader and team had the discipline, the skill, and they won, even though actually it was against you're part of, as you say, Ghana School, which is gonzo, take no prisoners, ruthless. You were in it, you did it with aplomb, Tova followed you, same. Well, I was going to say, do you regret, because I know there are parts you do, because I think you're on record as saying, but how do you look back on that?
Yeah, I mean, I loved that style of journalism.
Yeah.
You know, like, don't get me wrong. Like,
I'm not asking you to kind of whip your back or anything.
No, and I loved it, and there's a few sort of tiers to this. I love journalism where you're just like, throw off the shackles and just do stuff that no other – that's what I liked doing when I was a political leader, is just like actually doing stuff, saying stuff that no other journo would go, just like going to places where they wouldn't go. So that's why I love that sort of gonzo personality, plus bringing in sort of basically elements of comedy into your television reporting as well, and sort of the theatre of it all, so that you could – think of it like you're going over to the pub after a day in Parliament and your mates would say to you, what happened in there today? And you're just like, well, I'll tell you what happened. And your eyes would sort of lift up and you'd tell them this amazing sort of dramatic story about he said this, she said this. Anyway, you know, and your friends are there at the end just going, what's going to happen next? And you go, well, look out tomorrow, because I tell you what, this is happening. And I kind of...
That's a great way of thinking about it.
You know, I used to like to bring that to my reporting. And with politicians like yourself being so well-trained with media, so ambitious, trying to control it and plot against us, you know, to just be able to – it's a bit like what you were saying before, you know, like a jury trial or anything. Like, you're not meant to win. You're not meant to beat these guys. But if you can think of ways to sneak around the building and catch people in different places, or questions that will catch them off guard, or ways of showing it in the end, if you can use this little kit bag of tools that you've got available to you – to take on, you know, the 120 plus MPs and all the people that work for them and all the power of the political parties, and you can get, you know, you can get one up over them, or just expose them, or kind of show people what's really happening by using these things, then, you know, that's a victory for you. And so that would be my mindset. But, you know, where I have had regrets is just sometimes I would just lose that perspective in all of this, you know, and lose the sense of ridiculous, and it would become personal, and, you know, and maybe it's not going anywhere. Maybe, you know, you like to think you're always working for this massive greater good, and a lot of the time I was, heaps of the time I was, but whether I always had 100% perspective, like, I know that I didn't, and those are the bits that I regret, and for some reason I really have ended up in life regretting lots of stuff about what happened in Parliament. You know, I had a mental breakdown and had to quit the place. There's all of these sorts of things. But for some reason, over time, I've felt really bad about David Shearer, and I don't know why that is. I just have.
And, was a decent guy, and yeah. and you know, had a good. he actually, well, no, I won't get into that. But look, I was going to say,
Key was scared
potentially of Key. He could have been their best.
Yes.
At one level, and he didn't have the. He wasn't articulate, and that was an issue for him. But in other respects, his backstory was actually very good.
Yeah, and John Key. Was scared of him too initially. I know that, and it was really, you know, looking back, it was really important that actually David Shearer was tripped up by you guys, because he did have the potential to actually take you guys out of there.
An election
and
campaign.
And if he'd got there, and you know, all these different things, and maybe if he'd had a few more skills, you know, a lot of people say he just wasn't suitable. But I know that John Key was worried about him, and he was one guy that could have done it, but you know, and it wasn't the media that got rid of him, it was his own people.
Hey, Chris.
Yes.
Do you want another very broad question? I've got a very broad question today.
Go on then.
What do you know about sports?
Up the Wars! Go the Black Caps! And don't forget Premier League football.
Oh, you do love a bit of Premier League footy, don't you? What team is it that you support again?
Oh, the current champions, Manchester City.
I think they're pronounced Arsenal. It's pronounced Arsenal.
But you know what's good about football?
Yeah, what?
They don't regulate soccer. Right?
I'm sorry? There's a sport that regulates soccer?
Indeed there is, and it's cycling.
That's very strange. Why on earth do they regulate it?
Well, I know, but if you want to find out, you'll have to listen to the Big Stuff Quiz, wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, that's a cliffhanger indeed. The Big Stuff Quiz is brought to you by Melbourne Every Bit Different.
I just gonna say we're gonna need to keep moving. We spent too much time on politics, and this ain't a politics podcast. My favourite view was the just sticks in my memories chasing Chris Carter around the corridors. But he was my English teacher for a little while,
right?
By the way, so there you go.
Yeah, he was pretty fast.
Why? Why'd you go from politics to national correspondence? What was your
look? I
national correspondent.
I had ended up in Parliament, like. You know, I went down there for the New Zealand Herald, and it was actually not really something that I wanted to do. I was quite interested in going and working there, but I never thought that I would end up working there for 10 years. It's an institution. It is literally, as you know, you go in the doors in the morning and it's one big building filled with however many thousand people or whatever, and no one can get out, and there's all of these little things. And basically, I feel that it was like a prison for me.
Yeah.
It was like I did 10 years in there, which is the same that someone does for murder in Paramaribo, and then they get parole. And I was in that institution for 10 years.
And I think people don't understand. You do, as you say, my life in Parliament, 14 years in Parliament.
Yeah, you didn't
when
get
I was there, yeah, exactly, I would be there from early in the morning. I didn't leave the building like late at night, midnight. You know, often. So it's just, so people say, well, Wellington, you spend a lot of time in Wellington. I don't know Wellington very well at all, even though physically I spent probably years of my life there.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I had a mental breakdown in the end. And I actually.
What caused that? What was your, what would you sort of say now?
I think it was just a buildup of the pressure of the job of dealing with you guys and just constantly every day sort of having to watch your back constantly. Fighting, constantly doing deals, constantly just being on the clock and like an assassin or something, you know, and you're just there like with eyes in the back of your head, you doubt everything that everybody says to you, you question everything, you're trying to kind of take people out, you're kind of trying to win against the other media all the time, and I also just didn't have a plan to do any of this. Like, I wasn't doing it for a reason. I just sort of built all this stuff onto myself, and it actually just wasn't me. And, you know, as we know now, you know, I was an alcoholic as well during this time. And all of that just built up, and basically I just snapped and I actually just could not do the job anymore.
Would you say in yourself now you're in a much better place?
Oh, yeah. Or? Yeah, you know, that's
because you don't touch a drop?
That's 6 years ago now. Yeah, I don't touch a drop now. Right. And you know, I moved out into this national correspondent role, which was a roving role around the country outside of Parliament, which I've sort of stuck to. I don't do that job anymore. But
right.
Working out and about around New Zealand with different issues and stories and stuff with real people, you know, I'm still doing that on my new show and stuff like that. And that's given me a whole new perspective on New Zealand and a whole new perspective on the kind of work that I do. And it's just been like a cleansing process for me, really.
Because it's less political, it's more positive.
It's more positive. The people are real. You're closer to what's happening. I still love politics. I watch what's happening all the time and I read every column and, you know, I can see stuff and I'm like, oh yeah, I know what's going to happen next or whatever, because, you know, I've still got that mind, as you will as well, where I can, you know, break everything down and stuff like that. But, you know, for me, the kind of work that I did as a national correspondent, documentary maker, and now in my new show, Paddy Gower's Got Issues, you know, the kind of issues that we're doing, I've stuck with that, like stuff that's out and about. It's still political because it all leads back there eventually, but it's based around real people.
Tell us about Paddy Gower's Got Issues.
Well, I've got a lot of issues, as people would know.
It's a good name.
Yeah, it's a great name, and a guy at work, Todd Simmons, came up with it, and it's a fantastic name for the show, and I've been doing that this year, Simon, and for me, after leaving Parliament, this is the first really big challenge that I've had, consistent challenge. And there's been lots of little ones that I've done since then, but now it's back to having, I guess, for want of a better description, a big job again. And I'm really enjoying that. You know, there's a team that works with me every day, and you know, there's pressure on to get the show up every week, and you know, I'm just loving it. You know, we did an amazing issue last night around gender and transgender in New Zealand, and you know, you can get in and explore these things, and that's actually, I know this is going to sound lame, but that's what I love doing. Mm. I love putting stuff out there that pushes the agenda for people. There's no difference between doing that in Parliament. That's what I would try and do there, is set the agenda and push the agenda, and now I'm just trying to just take bigger issues and get out there and push these things out there so that people, I don't want to change people's minds or anything. I'm interested in doing work that makes people think. I'm really interested in that.
And what are you sort of, in terms of both your correspondent role before and now Paddy Gower's Got Issues, what are some of the issues that have most surprised you? I mean, did you go in, I mean, look, because we've all got, you're an experienced guy. I would too. You know, you do go in with a preconceived view of these things. Are there ones there that you've just come out full, genuinely, not because it was good for the TV, you came out and you genuinely thought, you know what, should I was entirely wrong about that, or that was just, this is very different to where I sort of thought it was?
Yeah, and, you know, I think the main one of those would be cannabis or weed.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't, you know, I was never against cannabis or weed, and like I smoked it, you know, when I was going through university, and, you know, I'd smoke it every now and then. But I was never really into it, didn't care for it at all, as a drug or whatnot, and you know, didn't mind that it was illegal. I just thought, oh well, that's the way things are, can't really see any point in it being legal. And then along the way, I was just amazed. I thought medical cannabis was just a joke. It was just I hadn't bothered to learn about it or anything like that. And along the way of dealing, you know, along the way of working with weed, you know, I completely changed my mind on it. You know, I think it's a fantastic medical option for people, particularly people with cancer at the end of their life, or for people who are dealing with anxiety and stress and stuff like that. It's a natural option with a lot of science behind it. And then with legalizing it, you know, I sort of really came around to the point that it should be decriminalised at the very least in this country, and that nobody should really be charged or clogging up the courts and that kind of thing with it. So, you know, that's really the classic example of going into something with a fixed view and coming out the other side completely different. Alcohol was the same. You know, I was a heavy drinker when I started working on alcohol, and by the end of it, I don't drink at all now, and I've changed my view totally on its place in New Zealand society. I don't talk a lot about it because I don't want to be someone that preaches to Kiwis, because I don't think Kiwis like being preached to.
No.
They don't like that. So although on weed and on alcohol, my views have completely changed. And I also look at the whole drug world in general differently now. You know, I guess I've got pretty liberal views on what should happen there. But I'm also working on something to do with vaping. And it's interesting working on that because I actually think that should be locked down.
Yeah.
So after years,
we're going somewhere we don't understand on that.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
We're going to look back in sort of 40 years and it'll be the new cancer or something.
Yeah, I've got a piece of work coming up on it, documentary coming up on it, and I think it is, you know, along with phones, it's the biggest, most stupid experiment that humans have done on themselves for a long time. You know, vaping and what we're doing with our phones as well is another area. Mm. But it's been interesting to get into the world of addiction, realize, you know, that I'm an addict. And you've actually asked a really good question here. Something that I've really something that I've really, really changed my mind on through all of my work is addiction, actually, because that sits underneath all of these conversations that we're having now about cannabis, alcohol. And I used to look at addicts as weak people. I used to look at people who were addicted to drugs or alcohol as people who were weak. And I used to think, why can't you give up? Why are you causing so much pain? You know, I know a lot of addicts, and one in particular that's quite close to me. And I used to see what it was doing to his mother, who was very close to me as well. And I just used to be like, why are you doing this to your family? Why are you doing this to your mum? What's your problem? Give up. Where is your strength? And I guess I would judge all addicts. Like, I literally, inside of me, thought that addicts were weak people. And that, you know, this is, by the way, ignoring the fact that I had an addiction to alcohol while I was doing this. That's how judgmental I was.
Mm.
And then the more that I came to learn about addiction through talking to people about it and learning about the science behind it, as soon as I started to learn more actually about science and the power of science as well, then I realized that addiction really, for most people, is a disease. And people are addicted for all sorts of different reasons, and not to judge them.
And so what's the what's the answer to that? Is it simply, not simple, but seeking help, changing? And if you are, as in your case, you actually just can't go there.
Yeah, I can't go there. And you know, everybody's approach to addiction is going to be different. My mum, she was a receptionist at a doctor's surgery, and she was a really good people person. And I remember she died a long time ago, and I remember someone said to me, you know, your mum is such a nice lady because she doesn't judge people. And I was like, oh yeah. And I remember once doing some sort of school project where, you know, you ask your parents what your superpower is, and my mum said that she doesn't judge people.
Mm.
And I never ever listened to that really again until later in life, and I spent my whole life kind of judging people and everything. But you know, that is a superpower for people, I think, if you can not judge people. And if you go and read the Bible and all sorts of different things, you know, that's something that goes back to the beginning of time.
Yeah.
And you know, that's something that I sort of want to try and be like, is emulate my own mum and not be judgmental about people.
I think probably because right across major religions, it's a real no-no, isn't it?
That's right, if you look at it.
But human nature.
Exactly.
We kind of,
yeah.
There's a lot out of that, and thanks for really powerful messages there. I mean, one thing that occurs to me, though, that I just sort of am interested in, you know, Guy Nespina, for example, is famous. You're in a book about it now. There you go. Issues based on booze. And if he happens to listen to this fantastic podcast, I bought it at your book launch. You've signed it. I haven't read it, to be fair, but it is sitting there by my bed. And I think about you sometimes. But anyway, press gallery, journalism, politics, you know, this is a real theme. Drink, alcoholism. I got to tell you on the other side, and I do know when I think about, you know, my wider circle, I do know some highly functioning alcoholics, right? They work hard and so on, but they need that booze. And you know that if you meet them, they need it, right? So I'm not naive. I got a bunch of people in my wider circle who I would say, in truth, are at some level alcoholics. In politics, on my side of the fence, though, by which I don't mean blue or red, I just mean politics, I don't know that I do know a lot of alcoholics, right? Yeah, we'd get on the booze on a Wednesday night, enjoy some single malts, but you know, I've said that's never been my issue. And if I look around my circle, wasn't. That's a bit of a rant, but why do you think on your side of it that was there? Because it's not just you.
Yeah, I think it is. You know, booze and journalism, they really do go together, I think, you know, because it's a way of decompressing after a sort of a stressful job that's literally got deadlines every day or whatever and stress and a need to debrief and tell yarns about it. They do fit quite nicely together, you know, like there's like something stressful happened at work this week on Paddy Gower has issues, right? This is a classic story for you. Something stressful happened at work, and I don't drink alcohol. I haven't bought around at the pub for ages. You know, I don't care. You know, like, and but here we were, and I took the team out for a drink, even though I have kombucha, because I couldn't actually think of a way to sort of bring the team down from what we were kind of going through, then pop in across the road for a drink. Like, that's how intertwined it is. It was like, yes. It was very surreal. I was sitting there going, I can't believe I'm doing this. You know, I'd prefer to go for a walk up Mount Eden or something like that, you know. But it's so intertwined in the culture that even as a non-drinker, I've ended up buying a round for the team, which is fine to help decompress from a really stressful, niggly incident at work. You know what I mean? It's like, well, how intertwined is this with what we do?
Yes.
Booze.
And deeply cultural and part of that mythology about journalism. Fleet Street, or wherever it is.
And ironically, you know, everybody felt better afterwards, including me, who didn't drink a drop. Everyone was like, hey, that was good to go and do that. And, you know, and that's, you know, that's all part of alcohol and stuff. It's fine for other people and it's intertwined in our culture to such a huge extent. You know, it's not for me. I'm an alcoholic. I can't stop when I start drinking. But
you miss it?
I do miss it from time to time. When we were sitting at the pub the other night, I was like, shivers, it'd be nice to actually have a couple of these with these guys. Mm. But I don't miss it to the extent where I want to, you know, sneak off and grab it or anything like that. But yeah, I definitely do miss it. And the camaraderie and the fun that comes with it is all this sort of distant memory for me now. But I don't miss it to an extent like I'm going to start drinking again.
Hey, well, thanks so much for that. It's powerful and you've been very candid and I really appreciate that. I mean, there's so much we could talk about. There's two or three things I want to get to, so we're going to keep moving. I've got written here, big moments, elections, international. I mean, later this year we've got an election. You know, I've got this view that a new prime minister with a new prime minister in Hipkins and opposition leader in Chris Luxon, those TV debates are going to be really important, right? I just think they could be even decisive, and I reckon people will tune into them because there's a lot of soft vote out there. You've conducted three in the past. Have I got that right?
No, I've done two. I've done Ardern in English and Ardern in Collins.
Right.
So I've done two of them. Yeah. So I know a little bit about them.
Well, yeah. Whether you did more than most, more than nearly anyone. I mean, what's your view on them? I suppose is a good general place to start.
Yeah, I think debates are absolutely crucial for choosing our leaders in this country because they're really, you know, they attract them. The number one reason is they attract a mass audience at a time when people are most switched in. You know, it is a time when people lock into politics, a lot of them who haven't watched over the last 3 years. And I also think there's another factor that plays into that. I believe that Kiwis give the opposition leader a chance once the campaign starts up as well. So Kiwis, you know, you're talking about these circadian rhythms. I think if an opposition leader can get to the campaign trail, if they can get there, they're
in with a sniff.
They're in with a sniff, always, because Kiwis, whatever it is about the way we are, they then decide to open up to these people a bit more. So that then means that the debates take on an extra level. There's obviously the political interest. There's this fact that people are giving them a fair go. And then there's also this new fact added into politics, which is we have a huge amount of early voting coming as well. So the debates are actually, in my mind, incredibly critical. You know, at that point they happen, people start voting pretty much straight afterwards now as well. So in some ways, you know, they're more critical than ever before. And with the splintered kind of media that we have and everything, there's no longer the days of the 6 o'clock news and watching it with your family and everything like that. It's really so. Yeah, basically, I think they're absolutely a massive moment in politics, and to be out there in the middle of it, you know, they're a debate. Nobody can help the leaders. Nobody can give them any answers when you're out there. They can't. You know, they can't do much. They've got to debate. They've got to answer. And as a moderator, that's a fantastic position to have them in, because what you're trying to do is set them up, or what I try and do is set them up with questions that they have to answer, and there is a tension there that if they do not answer and jump on it, the other person will and pick up the ball and run with it. And I don't want to give too much of my tricks away, but that's part of what I use in the research. You know, I will plot out with the team 5 to 10 possible steps off each question, where I think, based on what I know about each leader and their positions, where I think they will start to try and go. And having mapped what they've said and done and not said often, try and lead them into places where they have to say something about certain things, and then use the pressure of having the other person there who wants to jump in on it, doing that as well. You know, that and what I like to do with the leaders as well is get them freewheeling. I try and create a debate where they're forced to start thinking.
Beyond their silly little rehearsed
three or four
phrases.
And once you can get their brains moving, doesn't matter what it's on, just once you get their brains moving and you can see that both of them are in freewheeling, that's
in which case they're telling you what they actually think, possibly, if you've done a good job of that.
And I think in both debates that I've done, you've seen that. I've forced the leaders to think, forced them to say things that they normally wouldn't say and things that they think, which is when you get an amazing debate. And I mean, the ones that I've done, you know, the first one I did, English and Ardern, they were neck and neck in the polls. One, TVNZ had come out and put National ahead, and we'd come out and put Labour ahead. No one knew where they were. The two of them came together, you know, alongside someone like your good self. They're probably two of the best debaters in Parliament at that time. And, you know, and it was my first time moderating. And I can tell you this, I did not remember one thing when I walked off afterwards. I remember my dad coming into the changing rooms and telling me that I'd done a good job, and everything else was blank. I can remember in the last ad break,
he was there for it.
Yeah.
In the audience.
Yeah.
Is that a sort of like a lucky charm?
My old man was there, and it was a pretty big moment for both of us, you know, because I just never thought I'd do something like moderate a national debate, and you know, and I can remember in the last break, things sort of started to clear in my mind, and I was like, man, I've actually done a good job here. This has been a pretty interesting debate. And then it ended, and the only thing I can remember is my dad saying that I'd done a good job, which was pretty awesome feeling.
That's almost a good definition of what would be a good one, isn't it? If there's been surprising moments, because you've got them to a point where, and when you think about, I wanted to ask you, you've sort of answered it, but when we think about your role as the, you're much more than umpire, you're actually an interrogator, and you've got a role to put them through their paces, because you are testing not for whether they've passed standard four maths, but whether they are the right person to lead the nation.
Yeah, so you are an interrogator as well, and you know, it's such a unique role, which is why I love it. It's, for me, it's been the Mount Everest of journalism, doing the debates, because there's only one at a time for TV3, so you don't get to do two in the year. You don't get to come back 2 weeks later and go, hey, I'll improve. You're out there with one shot to make a good debate, and that means you know, massive amount of preparation so that you're ready. And then, like the leaders, no one can help you when you're out there. It's you. It's you and them. That's it. And that's a massive challenge as a broadcaster to be like that, you know, with the eyes of the nation on you as well. And you've got to interrogate, but you've also got to moderate and keep it moving, because Kiwis do not like over interrogation or the moderator taking over either. So you've got to, like, you can't just like give them 5 minutes each to have this and 5 minutes each to have that. You've got to get the interrogation going. But if you talk too much, you know, you won't be able to walk down the street, you know, for a little while later with everyone watching every word you say as well. So it is about you, because you've got to interrogate, you've got to keep them moving, but it's not about you as well. So you're sort of like, what do I do, you know? And
I maintain this will be the most important in decades, because both parties are under 40%, because they've both got weaknesses, and you've got two at a level new leaders where New Zealand public doesn't really have at a deep level a sense of them. So they're more important than ever. Will you be doing them for three?
I'll wait.
That's a yes, but I appreciate you probably not in a position to. Well, if you do.
Wait and see, or you know, I'm trying to think of what you guys would say to these sort of things.
What did John Key
used to say? There's only a few more sleeps. That's what he used to say to me.
I was going to say you've met Donald Trump. That's not really true, but you've done. How do those US elections compare with what we do?
Well, I've got as close as I've got closer than you are and I are together to Donald Trump. You know, and I've been into his ballroom at Mar-a-Lago as well. I was lucky to covered three American elections, believe it or not. You know, I covered Obama getting re-elected. I covered Trump getting elected, and then I covered Biden getting elected during COVID. So I've been over there three times. I know a lot about it. I've been to about 40 American states, and it's the most amazing election, and that's why Kiwis love watching it and to be there and see it. You know, to see the rise of Donald Trump, to get to ask him questions. I think I've asked him questions three times. You know, before he became president. And, you know, there's just too much security to get close to people once they become president. You know, I was there the day before Donald Trump. You know, I was in America the day before Donald Trump got elected. Like,
and
you know,
and
I'm
you
never going to
forget
that.
I mean, do you understand why he did? I mean, can you see that he and was he impressive? I mean, we have this view over here that's, you know, he's just this absolute everything that's wrong. And, you know, there's something in some of that. But,
yeah,
you know,
I mean,
can you see why and how?
I could definitely see it when I was over there. And I could actually see it the election before when Obama got re-elected and we ended up in some small town and there was all of this sort of this grumpiness and anger, which later, you know, people have written millions and millions of lines and books and different things on what's happened in America for Donald Trump to rise up. But I can sort of remember seeing it. But it was the day before he got elected that we were in this school gym in this place called Scranton in Philadelphia, which was a sort of Democratic area, but, you know, was going to flip by the looks of things to Donald Trump. And it had all this history. Joe Biden grew up there and all that sort of thing. And I remember being in the school gym there and Donald Trump came to speak. And I can remember sitting there going, holy shit. Like, whatever the atmosphere was, whatever the feeling in the air was. And I think, you know, there's always something in the air before an election, whether it's in America or New Zealand or whatever, there is this sort of this kind of foreboding kind of feeling. But I remember sitting there going, I'm watching history here. This guy's going to do it. If people are acting like this elsewhere around America, there is going to be a boil over tomorrow, which there was. And I can remember feeling it. And I said something to that effect on TV, and at that point, you know, it was quite hard reporting on Donald Trump actually at that point, because, you know, in New Zealand everybody hates him and they've all got views on American politics, a lot of them without actually having been there and seen what's there. And but I remember saying something to that effect, you know, not a prediction, and that if there was more Scrantons, then he's going to do it. And there were more Scrantons. There were hundreds, if not thousands, more Scrantons, and that's how he did it in 2016. So I can definitely remember it. And despite everything that it caused for America and everything, seeing it just as a spectacle of history, seeing the rise of Donald Trump so closely, you know, that's something that is really sort of special to me, just observing it.
And the absolute remarkable thing is he might do it again. I've got to wrap up asking you the question we ask every guest. We call this section general knowledge. For you, there's no politics involved. If you could be, well, there might be. If you could be somebody else for a day, who'd it be?
Oh, my God, that's a good one. I would love to, and you'll find this really interesting. I would love to be a prosecutor or a defense lawyer in a big trial.
Yeah.
I would actually, that is something that I would love to try, you know, and obviously I could never go and do all the training, all the time that is required to kind of get there. But if I could do something to see what it was like, I would really like to, I'm talking about a high stakes trial.
Yeah.
I would actually like to be, and I wouldn't really mind being the Crown Prosecutor or the defense lawyer. I'd quite happily do either. Yes. But that is actually something, like, this is actually a really good question. I've never thought about this before.
Well, that's a role I've done.
I know, before,
I know. And I can tell you, it's harder than journalism or politics. because you get your phrases wrong.
Yeah.
You don't quite get it right, and you're in the freaking Court of Appeal. And
it's
in its way, it's forensic, a bit like being a surgeon. I mean, it doesn't, no one in that moment is dying or living, but it's so it's great to hear that. What's your most embarrassing moment?
Oh, that's easy. When I forgot my passport and John Key was going to Iraq, and I left my passport back at the hotel, and I couldn't go on the plane because we had to go through customs to leave, and the plane had to leave without me.
Did you get there? No.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Got on another
plane. They got turned back because of a sandstorm, and I got the biggest second chance of my life. I probably would have got fired. That is how bad that things were. And, you know, Key had to hold the plane for me to go. He was going to meet the president because we were going back into town to get it. He was going to meet the president of Iraq. And I'll always have to thank him for this. Apparently, he held the plane for about 15 minutes to see if I could get back, which is pretty damn nice considering I was a journalist who made his life absolute hell.
Well, he knew the power of the press, though.
That's right.
He thought that was worth two good stories.
No, the camera was still on there, so he would have been fine. That was the exact kind of media that a politician wants, camera only.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Yeah, that was embarrassing. That was embarrassing.
If money was no object, what are the first three things you'd buy?
Oh, this is another good question. Okay, let me think. Well, money's not huge to me, but I don't know if this is three things or one or whatever, but I would really like to move back to Awakura Beach in Taranaki and have a house on or near the beach and be able to live there. So what would I need? I'd need the house, I'd need the house, the view of the mountain, and the beach. Is that sort of three things? But if I won lotto or if I could have whatever, that's probably all that I'd want, would be able to live back, at that beach, close to the mountain, and being able to see the mountain, be close to my family and friends, and that would be awesome. That would actually be my life dream.
Fantastic.
Yeah, is that a good answer? Wasn't good
answer,
three things.
Fantastic answer.
Kind of about 10, but one.
No, it's okay. Famous actor that would play you in the movie of your life?
Well, earlier on we said, you know, character actor. We need a character actor. I don't know. I've always thought he's not an actor, but I've always thought Lyle Lovett had a sort of
vibe. See that.
Yeah. So no, I don't know. It would have to be a character actor. But you know, speaking of character actors that you mentioned earlier, like that's something I'd, you know, if I couldn't do the court thing.
I could see
maybe
it.
A character actor would work.
I could see you doing that. You'd be good at it. If you could choose to stop aging at any age, what would it be?
Well, it would be age 46, which is now. Today.
Likewise.
So, yeah,
you and I are
the year
of 76.
And this is not even an answer.
Let's not compare and contrast our physical fitness.
But I will say, if I could stop aging, I would want to stop aging today. Because I'm feeling every minute of 46 and a half, and I'm sort of every day I'm noticing, you know, today I was coming in and, you know, I can't see stuff that's on screens anymore, you know, the hearing's going, you know, I'm so, my flexibility is terrible. So yeah, stop right now, please.
Fantastic. Hey, it's just been a pleasure. Thanks so much. I can call you this now, Paddy Gower. You've been listening to Generally Famous, a Stuff podcast. There's a new episode every Wednesday. You can listen to them all at stuff.co.nz/generallyfamous or wherever you get your podcasts. In fact, if you follow us on Apple or Spotify, any of the podcast apps, in fact, you'll get the latest episode automatically. Sounds good, right? Thanks to my producers, Chris Reed and Jen Black, and audio editor John Rapiha. I'm Simon Bridges. I really appreciate you listening.
If you liked listening to this pod, help us make more like this. Visit stuff.co.nz/support.
If you don't have time to read the in-depth stories, or you just prefer to listen instead, the Long Read from Stuff is the podcast for you. Each week, we showcase one of our excellent pieces of journalism, telling important or entertaining stories from the world of crime, sport, history, culture, and more. You also get to hear from the journalists themselves about how they uncovered the story and how it came to life. So, for your weekly dose of long-form journalism, beautifully read, subscribe to the Long Read from Stuff wherever you get your podcasts.